This is an interview with Maureen Fallon on the 21st of May in 2018. This interview is held in the State Library of South Australia and is part of the Women's History Project. Thank you, Maureen, for coming. Would you like to give me your name and a brief overview of when and where you were born and grew up?
Maureen Sandra Fallon is my name. I was born in Scotland and educated there until I was 13, and then the rest of my schooling happened in Belfast in Northern Ireland, and then I went to England to become a librarian in Birmingham. And in 1970, having qualified and worked in libraries in England, I came to Adelaide and started work in the State Library in 1970.
Thank you. Okay, so I know you were involved with the formation of the Women's Information Switchboard, as it was in those days, so that's the term I prefer to use, if that's all right with you. They call themselves service now.
Oh, really?
Yes,
oh.
The switchboard disappeared over time. So can you give me some of the background and the context of how you got involved with the Women's Information Switchboard?
I'll try and make it relatively brief until we get to the real subject of the discussion. I was a librarian, and as happens with many women, I was married, I had a child, and I wanted to continue working once the available 6 months leave was up. And I was told at that time by the state librarian that it was impossible for me to continue in a senior role on a part-time basis, and that kind of social change would take 20 years to occur, and it certainly wasn't up to him to institute it. I resigned, feeling fairly devastated. My career was over, my identity was over, simply because I wanted to be a good mother. A month later, I had been discussing part-time employment with the Public Service Association and with various people around the place. And so 4 weeks after I resigned from the State Library, I was recruited to become a part-time employee, which technically wasn't possible, but somehow or other we made it happen, in the newly established Women's Advisory Unit in the Premier's Department. So I worked there. The job that was given to me and the reason I was employed was to try and have permanent part-time employment introduced throughout the public service in South Australia. Through a great deal of wonderful work with many people. That came about 9 months later, which I thought was very significant in terms of a time lag. In the process, however, one of the arguments that we had used for the importance of part-time employment for women was that it allowed you to stay in the workforce and be seen and be noticed and develop your skills. So indeed, after 9 months working on the part-time employment project, people in the policy division of Premier's department had noticed my work. The Premier at the time, Don Dunstan, wanted to do something about the parlous state of library and information services in South Australia. And to cut a long story short, I was employed full-time as executive officer to a committee that was being established, the Library Services Planning Committee. So I worked on that, sort of managed that process, if you like, with the chairman, Jim Crawford, who was also on the library's board and a private businessman and a very active participant. And while we were doing that, it took place in the Premier's department, and I was still geographically very close to the Women's Information, to the Women's Advisory Unit. In conversation with Andy Sebastian and Deborah McCulloch, they talked about how they'd had this idea, Andy had had this idea of establishing a switchboard. She'd been to San Francisco at some stage to Haight-Ashbury and she'd seen something like that. And so they were talking about this fairly vague idea of a women's information switchboard. And being the very practical person that I am, I would say, well, how are you going to do that? You know, you haven't got any money, you haven't got any way of establishing it, etc., etc. And I thought about it for a while, and in the context of the Library Services Planning Committee, we had an allocation, I think it was $20,000 from memory. We had an allocation for a specific special project dealing with information services. And I thought to myself, well, these two are never going to get it together as an idea. But if we were to link it to the provision of information services, it would be perfectly appropriate to establish something like that. So I put it to my committee, or rather, you know, the committee, and talked, of course, at great length with Deborah and Andy, and we worked extremely hard over quite a long period of time to translate their fairly radical ideas into a sort of bureaucratically admissible acceptable. And acceptable form, which took a lot of work, I might say. But it was a good mix. It was a good mix of skills, really, between them and myself. And I then had to persuade my committee to accept that idea. And they did, which was wonderful. It was really amazing. And I must say that for me personally, the thing that really I've never forgotten about that was Andy's mantra at the time. The mission for the Women's Information Switchboard was to take every woman seriously and to listen. And I have adopted that in my own life ever since, not just for women, but for everybody, really, that we all want to be heard and we all deserve to be heard. And so the Women's Information Switchboard started from that premise was really vital, and I hope to this day that it continues. It also had to work within a government atmosphere
framework.
A framework, and that required me to be quite firm in trying to persuade them, really, of how it might work. And one of the things that we collectively decided upon very early in the piece, and it was vital, I think, to it being successful, was that it would be apolitical, and that we had to involve women from all walks of life, and there would be women from the Labour side of things, women from the Liberal side of things, women from the Country Women's Association, women from the city, all ages, all types, all beliefs, whatever. And I think that was a large part of its success. And I had to, from my angle, I had the job of trying to find a location for this service. And so what we actually managed to do was to take the old Institute building on the corner of North Terrace and Kintore Avenue. And there was a large room there. And we managed to acquire the use of that.
Well, two rooms, really. The front room and the one behind was the meeting room.
Really?
There were two rooms there.
Yeah, okay, two rooms. I don't remember that. I mean, I don't remember.
Yeah.
But
well,
I just remember the big...
Ago.
Yeah, that's right. But we certainly... So I had to, again, you know, convince the library people. We had quite a lot of leeway. We were quite a powerful committee, and we had the authority to really make decisions over and above the library hierarchy. And so... it wasn't all that easy, but we managed to get the space and get the support. I'm not sure that we entirely got the support of the head of the library, but we did get the support of many, many other people.
You obviously charmed the library's board into it somehow.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
So who was on the library's board back then? Any idea? Just one.
Jim was the chairman.
He was the chair,
board,
I can
and
remember
he was a
that,
mover
yeah.
and shaker. Tony Brown, I think, was on the library's board. He was
a
librarian.
That's a familiar name, yeah.
He was at the Institute of Technology.
Oh, yeah.
And who else was there? I can't remember.
Curious, because I have a library background. I'm just interested.
It's such a long time ago.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, I did end up... that's a further story down the track, really. But... I suppose we had enormous support from the Public Service Board as well. Mary Beasley was Public Service Board Commissioner.
Yes.
And so we did have a lot of high-level support. We had support from, the Women's Advisory Unit was responsible for some of that. I mean, Deborah was amazing in getting those very senior men in the public service on side. They didn't necessarily believe it all, but they kind of were intrigued by these wild women. And there were some extraordinary... social events, when I remember the head of the Premier's Department and the head of the Public Service Board and all these people, all these men singing, liberty, fraternity, like up with the women, sort of I mean, it was extraordinary times.
It was amazing,
Hedley Backman, I think, was the head of the Premier's department. So we got everybody on side, really. And
well, the time was right, wasn't it?
Well, it was a good time, but I think people might forget how hard it was.
The '70s.
It was the end of the '70s.
You know, we had made some social changes, and it was more.
I think we had Don Dunstan. That
was
really important.
Don Dunstan was really incredibly important, wasn't it? Because it was a time of change.
It was.
And trying to do something.
Well, I can tell you now that in terms of getting the part-time employment thing through the Public Service Board, the commission, I kind of co-opted myself onto the Equal Opportunities Board.
Oh, yeah.
Which was mainly the Public Service Board commissioners. And there was a marvellous man called Jack, I can't remember his surname. He was a fabulous, really old-time bureaucrat. And he was absolutely instrumental in actually making all of this work within the public service side of things, public service board side of things. And if he hadn't been there, I think we would have had a much more difficult situation. And I would go to those Equal Opportunity Board meetings, and I would hear those commissioners. I remember David Mitchell was one, and I can't remember the others. But they would say things like, well, my wife doesn't need to do this. You know, I don't see why this is important, you know. They really had that view. It was incredible. Mm-hmm. And one of the shifts that happened, as you say, things were changing. One of the things that happened, this went on for nearly a year, one of the shifts was when their wives decided they wanted to work. And maybe get a little part-time job. And you could see that that was making a difference. So we did all the international studies. We wrote copious reports on, you know, all the experience around the world and the statistics and everything else. They always wanted more and more and more information.
Well, and a research librarian, they had the right person to do.
Well, in a way they did. I mean, Jack and I did this huge report on the whole thing. But fundamentally, it was prejudice that we were trying to work against,
of course,
really.
Yeah.
And in fact, I don't know if it's appropriate really to this discussion, but it might be important to people who might ever hear this, because I think the idea still works. I got the part-time employment thing through a little bit of devious luck, fortuitous circumstance. There was an election coming up, and I suggested to the Premier that he say that he would introduce permanent part-time employment if they won the election. And he said, well, he would do that if, you know, there was support for it. So I established a community committee. So I brought people in from outside. We had people from SACOS, people from all the women's areas. And we had a Premier's committee of non-bureaucrats, you know, advising us on whether this was a good idea or not. And we had the Public Service Board and we had the Superannuation Board.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the Public Service Board and the Public Service Association.
Okay.
So the Public Service Association was getting a little bit of flack from people like me and others. And so they said, oh, yeah, well, you know, we'd support it. They didn't really want to support it, but they said they would.
Yeah.
They certainly hadn't supported me when I was trying to get part-time employment.
Well,
they said they would.
Not always.
The Public Service Board said, because the Premier was pushing through us, of course, and so the Public Service Board said, well, we will introduce it, but unfortunately the Superannuation Board can't deal with that. And so unless the Super Board can do it, then we can't possibly introduce this. So we said, really? So I wrote letters at the time. I had all these letters. I had the Premier write to the Super Board saying, do it. The Super Board said, and they'll do it, and the Public Service Board will also, you know, do it. So the Super Board said, okay, well, we can do it. So we said to the Public Service Board, well, the Super Board can do it, so your main excuse is gone. So they had no choice. The community was pushing the Premier and, you know, the politics of the situation. And so the Public Service Association had said they would do it, but they didn't really think it was going to happen. So fundamentally, my advice to any young people or anyone coming after on any kind of, hard-fought community issue is there was five different players there. And you had to kind of persuade
All of them?
All of them, and none of them really wanted to do it. But if they thought everybody else was going to do it, then they would do it.
Mm.
And that's exactly what happened.
That's how exactly what happened. Off each other. Yeah.
Mm. So we got permanent part-time work, which was really good.
Yeah.
And that is, to me, that was an excellent learning exercise, you know, for just how things happen. And, you know, it was
And that,
was
that experience must have been very helpful for you when you were trying to help Deborah and Andy get the Women's Information Service funded.
Absolutely.
Whose idea? Do you remember where the idea of employing staff using an employment scheme, the NEET scheme or the RED scheme or something?
There was CEP or something?
CEP.
I can't remember.
They had one-year funding for paid staff, I remember.
We did.
And there was a lovely diverse range of women chosen right back then at the beginning.
And if you could find Rosalie, I think. Ros Johnson, yeah. She would.
I don't know. She wasn't very well last time I heard about her. Yeah, so
I don't know.
Carmel would know.
Yeah.
I can ask what happened to Ros Johnson. I'll follow up because she would be really good to interview because she was the first coordinator. I'll ask about Ros because I know some people who may know.
Yeah. Mm. And then Carmel.
And you might be able to. And, well, Carmel has been interviewed for this project. Yeah. So. And I remember Carmel was often stereotyped as the Catholic mother of six.
Absolutely she was,
And I was often stereotyped as the doctor's wife.
Oh, really?
When we were doing
publicity. Wonder what I was stereotyped as. I dread to think.
We used to use it as part of our promotion that we weren't these wild, rabid feminists, that we were, although we were all those things, we were also these other stereotypes.
That's true, and that was really important.
Yeah.
And in fact, when the Women's Information Switchboard first started and we had these sort of opening events of various kinds, we made sure that we had the CWA ladies, we had the Liberal ladies, we had the Labour people, we had everybody. And it really was amazing how everybody got on really well together because we all needed the same things.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Because part of my role was to set up the support group.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah.
Betty Fisher.
Betty Fisher
was a force to be reckoned with.
She was wonderful.
Betty Fisher.
She was wonderful.
And because I was involved with Well at the time.
Yeah.
And.
Well, Julie Ellis, you must have known Julie Ellis.
I knew her. Yeah. I sort of knew. And Joan Russell I had the most to do with in those days. But Betty Fisher pushed and shoved me and told me that I needed to run this support group because this organisation would never survive if it didn't have the support of all those, the Catholics and the Liberal women and the Labour women and all those different groups. Mm. And it was my job to organise meetings get them to come in every month to get an update on the service and what it was doing and send out little newsletters and all those sorts of things.
Well, there's a lot of work went into maintaining that support for the service.
Absolutely.
Because
and
I must
it
say...
still has kept it going.
Right.
Now, that's why some of the other Women's Information Services interstate have gone because they didn't have that support.
Yeah.
And this one... it's still up until the last two
That's
or three years, they have had support group meetings.
Mm.
Still, all those years, a lovely woman called Felicity Lord, Fliss, ran the support group for about the last 10 or 15 years that I know of and kept everybody on side. And when at one stage the government wanted to cut the service...
Mm-hmm.
All these letters suddenly came pouring
in. Well, they actually, governments wanted to cut the service almost from the beginning, really.
Mm.
And we had to keep, every time there was any hint of an election or any change, we really had to keep these meetings going where everybody came together and went, no, this is important, we need to have it.
Mm.
And, it was under threat constantly, really. It probably still is, you know.
And
but
Tonkin,
one of the things, Tonkin.
Tonkin's the one who gave them permanent positions.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he'd just taken
over. Mm. Yeah. I wouldn't mind putting in a comment here when you say that the services in the other states didn't last.
Some of them haven't.
Yeah. What a few years later, there's a lot of water that went under the bridge, but years later, I was working in Victoria.
Oh, yeah.
And at a pretty senior level. And they... some of the women had started WIRE, I think
they
called
it
there.
WIRE, yeah.
And one of the things I would say in a broad sense, which I've always said to anyone who'll ever listen about the difference between South Australia and the eastern states or other states, is that in South Australia, when we want something to happen, everybody gets together and cooperates. Mm. So whether it's the community, it's this political party, that political party, it doesn't matter, you know, one particular religious group, another, we all, if we want something to happen, we all kind of get together and we do it.
Cooperate, yeah.
But in the eastern states, I must say, when I went to work there, I observed, and I think it's still true really, it's dog eat dog in a really serious way.
Mm.
And they don't actually, they'd rather have a fight than actually make something happen.
Mm.
Whereas here, I think, we might have our differences, but we actually would rather have make something happen.
And that was the lovely thing about WIS. You had the women's from Women's Liberation.
Yeah.
You had the lesbian women. You had all different groups of every different possibility, all working together for the same purpose. It was really wonderful.
It really was wonderful.
Really old women in their 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And women who were in their 20s and students. It was just wonderful.
And some of those old women, I remember, I mean, I was young at the time. I mean, it was early 30s, I suppose. And actually, to my shame, I'll tell you this anecdote for the I shouldn't, because it's not doesn't set me in a good light. But when I went to work in the women's unit, I have to say that I wouldn't have called myself a feminist. And I remember I had been heard to say in the women's unit, oh, look, I don't know why it needs to be like this. Men and women, like, we're all the same, you know, why don't we all just sort of get on with it and whatever. Mea culpa, mea culpa, my God, you know. It changed. But, you know, that's how I came into it, really. And the other good thing about how I came into my job and so the subsequent job in terms of the planning committee and whatever, I was never very fond of Don Dunstan in those days. We'd come from England after a very disastrous Labor government. Right. Harold Wilson. The pound in your pocket will not be devalued, and it was the next day.
Mm.
So, you know, I wasn't really, you know, dyed in the wool.
Labour supporter.
Yeah. And what I loved about being employed in the Premier's department was that no one asked me how I voted. No one asked me. It didn't matter.
No.
What mattered was the issue and your merit, your competence.
And what work you did.
Yeah.
And
then, of course, as I did work in the Dunstan government for quite some time, I subsequently, I have to say, I mean, my opinion of that man just went up and up and up and up, because he had vision and he had principles and he wanted to see things done.
And he wasn't prepared. He was prepared to, you know, let things, experiments happen.
Oh God, yeah. Some of them I remember. Yeah. I think when he established the Alternative Lifestyles Committee in the Premier's department, I thought he'd gone a bit far, really, because.
What were they looking
at? Just seemed like a contradiction in terms, you know. Yeah. They had Jim Cairns chairing it. I mean, it was a hoot. It was a hoot. And, of course, he'd been up in northern New South Wales. I've just come from, actually. Yeah. You know, when he and I, we went, when I went to Victoria, I was Deputy Director General of the Ministry of Employment and Training after the State Library hearing debacle. He came across to Victoria too as Director of Tourism. So we'd find ourselves at the same
meetings
and things. And then, of course, he'd been up in far north Queensland, and I had a place up in far north Queensland now. So there was this, it's not that we knew each other particularly, you know, but
we just moved in similar
circles, you know.
Yeah.
It was quite funny, but I think he was a real visionary. And unfortunately, the person who came after him, without going into any great detail, although he was a good man, I'm sure, I got sick of the refrain, this is no longer the Dunstan government. This is not how it is. And so you went, all of that stuff went out the window, really. Mm. All that kind of.
Although we did manage to get ongoing funding for the service, and it kept on going, which was fairly extraordinary, really. And without the support of the Liberal women, I don't think it would have happened.
Mm.
Helen Storer was one of the names that I remember from way back then.
Yeah.
She was seen to be the switchboard representative. She used to come to all the meetings.
Yeah.
And she was the woman on the Liberal Party council or whoever it was.
Yeah.
I don't know. who must have been trying to battle the still entrenched issues that they have.
I mean,
in that
I remember
party.
Again, this is jumping forward a little bit, but of course, when the government changed in 79 from Labor to Liberal, mm-hmm. Murray Hill was. We went from John Bannon to Murray Hill, and Guy Laidlaw was his assistant. And I mean, they wouldn't even listen to anything I might say for about 18 months, probably, you know. Yeah. They just, you know, you were seen as a Labour person. Mm. But I have always said since, and again, this is heretical, so.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
Anyway, this is history. This is old history.
It's history.
But
yeah.
I always said I got more. The Labour people wrote much better submissions about things, thought through, you know, much more cautious, whatever. The Libs didn't seem to care about whether you wrote and it made much sense or not, you know, but they would make decisions.
Mm.
And so I always said I got more Labour Party policy through the government under the Liberals than I ever did under Labour, which is interesting.
Interesting, isn't
Very
it? Well,
interesting.
Diana Laidlaw ended up being a great supporter of Wes anyway over time.
Yeah.
She and Jennifer Cashmore and who else was he? Jennifer Adamson Cashmore. I think she changed her name halfway through. Mm. And there were a couple of other Liberal women at that time.
Mm.
I still see them around town occasionally at arts-type things.
Right. Yeah.
And I've seen Jennifer Cashmore and Diana Laidlaw, Liberal, and Anne Levy.
Anne Levy,
from
I was
the
just going to say Anne Levy.
And Anne Levy, all sitting and chatting away about the old days.
And Susan Lenihan.
Susan Lenihan, and there's another woman whose name escapes me. Who was a mate of Susan Lenihan. I see all that group of those senior politicians from way back then.
I think it was a time.
And everybody really did cooperate, and they seemed to be, they'd have their political stances, but they could cooperate and collaborate, which is really lovely.
It was, it is. It was and is. It's good.
It's not what happened to Julia Gillard, I don't think, but it's hard. No. That's different times, I guess. But that was impressive, my memory of how they all cooperated.
Yeah.
And, you know, they still seem to all get on quite well when you see them socially out and about.
That's
you
good.
Know, they wouldn't know who I am, but I just recognise all the faces because being an ex-teacher, I'm very good on faces and names. And I can recognise people.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's see where we got to.
Well, we've just got to the establishment of it, I think.
We've
really.
Got to the establishment. Let's talk about how it was set up in terms of how was it decided that we worked 9:30 till 9:30, 7 days a week, have paid staff and volunteers. Can you remember how that all happened?
Well, not really.
Was that Andy? More Andy?
Well, I think we all knew that women's issues don't just deal 9 to 5.
That's right. They do now.
Do they? That's sad. Yeah, that's sad. And also, I must say, being a little bit equivocal about the paid staff routine, and that I remember quite some years later, and I don't remember how many years later, but there was a time when it seemed the staff were a bit more interested in their own pay structures and hierarchies than they were in actually providing the service. Mm. I was sad about that. That
happened from time to time. Depend on the individuals, in my experience, because having been both a paid staff member and a volunteer, it really vacillated.
Yeah.
And the attitude towards volunteers, in my experience, it depended on who you were working with, really.
Yeah.
Some of them were definitely focused about themselves, and some of them had a much broader approach.
The other thing about the volunteers is that you needed volunteers because the range of women's issues and the things that happen to women go right across the spectrum. So you needed lawyers and you needed doctors and you needed all sorts of different people who could actually, you know, people from housing and, you know, all sorts of...
You needed contacts,
you
networks.
You needed really good networks. And that was one of the things that the Women's Information Switchboard did brilliantly, was to actually have those networks. And so people could use them. You could ring up and you could have a problem with either custody battles or health or whatever, and you could actually be referred usefully through the system, not just given a phone number, but actually, I suggest
you
ring so and so.
You talk to.
And
that
it was great. And
that
I think actually
referrals is really
the switchboard
important.
because it was so good at networking and brought people together, that actually helped that process, you know.
I think
it's really important. And it wasn't about just getting people to work for free. It was about sharing. It was equally useful, I'm sure, for all the people who were volunteering. You know, because they themselves were building networks.
I was totally educated by the Women's Information Service. I mean, I was a card-carrying feminist running parts of women's electoral lobby and marching the streets and doing all sorts of things, but I wasn't in part of the Women's Liberation Group. I was more on the other side of it, but and more on the conservative side, I suppose you could say. But that was part of the joy for me. I met and worked with people like Jo Wilmot, first Aboriginal worker, who really sorted me out and gave me lots of education about Aboriginal people, and accused me of, that's a very racist remark, and I was like, oh, was it? I didn't mean to be. So she educated me. And the same with those multicultural workers.
Yeah.
The Louisa Sheehan's, the Nikki Dimitropoulos.
Yeah, I remember Nikki.
All those different women.
Different women,
really. That's educated me.
And would have been great for them to meet all of you. Yeah. I mean, you know, all the different people coming together.
We had some amazing.
I mean, you know, sorry.
That's all right.
I was just going to say it started in 79. I was still involved in library and information services. So KISA was another one of my babies.
Can you explain?
It was the Community Information Services of South Australia.
That's right.
And that was set up under SECOS and proved to be a really useful exercise as well. And by this stage, I was also running the State Library, reorganising it. The Mortlock Library came through me. The Public Records Office, you know, the Adelaide Lending Service, all sorts of stuff, you know, whatever. But why am I telling you this? There's a reason. Well, yeah, because, of course, I was also involved in the awful, drastic, terrible situation of being nominated to having run the State Library for 18 months. And the way it was structured was very unfair in the beginning, which I was devastated about. I was the obvious person to be the state librarian, the new state librarian. But my boss said, basically, we can't appoint you, you know, to that job. We're going to remove the state librarian, but we can't appoint you. And I said, what do you mean? Like, I've been doing it for, you know, I've been doing all the stuff for now 3 years or something. And he said, oh, it would look too political. And I went, what are you talking about? That's ridiculous. You know, I mean, it's crazy. And he said, no. So what I'll do is we'll give the title and the money to the guy running the public libraries who we'd appointed. I'd written the bloody letters saying how good he was when he came from Victoria. And you can actually run the state library. And I will write in writing, I'll put something in writing to him and to you saying he is not to interfere in the running of the state library. So you'll be the acting deputy state librarian and he'll be the acting state librarian, but in name only. And I went, that's unjust. Yeah, that's unbelievably totally unjust. And do you know, nearly all my friends and family said, Maureen, why are you so uptight about it? I mean, you know, I think deputy state librarian's a really good job. You know, why are you so? I'm going, because it's not fair. It's not right. So fundamentally, what I did then over the next 18 months was to restructure and do the redo the state library. We had the wonderful binding exhibition all the way down the foyer, which 27,000 people saw in 3 weeks. And, oh, it was amazing what we did. We did the Mortlock Library. We did all sorts of stuff. And I was really busy working with the people in the State Library. And then 18 months down the track, as he had said, the job will be advertised. You'll have been doing it. You know, there'll be no issue then. So the job was advertised. I applied. All the men in the public service, as well as the guy in charge of the public libraries, applied. And the committee, the selection committee, was the Warren Horton, who became the National Librarian, head of the Mary Beasley, Public Service Board Commissioner, Jim Crawford, somebody else, and a staff representative, Bev Whitten, I think her name was. Anyway, it was a very high-powered...
Bet Whitten.
That's right. It was a very high-powered committee, selection committee, and I was the unanimous choice. But nothing happened. Instead of the nomination coming through, nothing happened. And nothing happened. And a couple of weeks passed. I mean, usually they do it the next day almost.
Mm.
And it got to the point where the Premier, who was John Bannon by that stage, got furious. And he basically rang the Public Service Board commissioners and said, get down here to Parliament House, to my office. What's going on? Why have you not made this nomination?
Mm.
So they made the nomination. And then they leaked a little bit to the Advertiser. So in the Advertiser the next day, it said, Ms. Maureen Fallon's been nominated for the position of State Librarian. The Public Service Board believe it hasn't been advertised widely enough and expect a number of appeals.
Oh, what bad.
So needless to say, everybody who applied appealed.
They would.
Now, a couple of the guys dropped out, but then there was, I think it was three of them, Ewan Miller and a couple of other guys who'd been, one was in the Education Department and one was somewhere else. And so then there was another 6 months before the appeal was heard, and I was busy. I was running the place, and I just thought, truth will out. I mean, it's Blind Freddy can see what's happening here, you know.
Yeah, I'm doing it.
So I didn't actually bother. I just thought, tell the truth, you know, tell what I've done.
Yeah.
Went into this, I don't know if this is it's interesting women's stuff.
It is.
Went into the appeal hearing. It was a two-day hearing. And, you know, I was I was quite relaxed. I know Warren Horton had offered to be a witness, a referee, and so had Jim Crawford.
Hmm.
And the Public Service Board guys had actually advised me, that's not how it's done. We don't have witnesses at appeals, and you don't need it. It's fine. It will be okay.
Hmm.
So I said, no, don't bother. So I was just in there by myself. The committee was an agricultural biologist, a lawyer, and an accountant.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
And the agriculture guy was well known for believing that the female was definitely inferior to the male. So I didn't have much of a hope in hell, really. And it went really badly. And really, the crunch came. I've never forgiven Ian McPhail for this. He and I, we'd worked together now for nearly 5 years.
For five years, you know.
Mm. And at one point, so Ewan Miller got up and he said, well, I've been the acting state librarian and we have reorganised the state library and we've done the moat law and we've done this, we've done that, all the things I'd done.
He claimed it all.
He claimed it all. And he could because he was the acting state librarian,
yes.
Right?
Oh, no.
And I'm sitting there with my mouth going, what?
But who practically did it
and,
all?
And then he said, and what's more, he said, here is a letter that I was given when I was appointed to the position. And of course it said, you know, you're wonderful, you're fabulous. I'd written it myself, I think, you know, sort of, that McPhail had sent. He said, and I have never been advised otherwise that I'm doing anything other than a perfect job. And the judge, the guy who was the chairman, he turned to McPhail and he said, is that so, Dr. McPhail? And I'll never forget looking at McPhail's face. And I thought, yeah, you bastard. Because if he'd said, it's not true, and I haven't told him, I haven't been a good manager myself, he was stuffed. And so he said, that's true. And I'd, you know, that was it, really. So anyway, at the end of the appeal process, nothing was heard again. Nothing was heard again for weeks.
Months.
But Anne Levy and all the women were up in arms. This is a women's issue. You know, the women were up in arms and questions were being asked all over the place. And eventually the answer, came down. And the Premier got the result, which was Ewan Miller. I lost the appeal. And Bannon was not impressed with that, to his credit.
Because he knew who'd
done
all the work.
Of course he did, yeah. And so he took it to Cabinet. No, he went to the Governor first to say, look, do I have to appoint this guy, you know, really? Or, you know, is this kosher kind of thing? Is this legal? And the government, I'm a bit hazy here. I can't remember, actually.
Yeah, I was just trying to think.
But, I mean, the advice was basically it's possible to not appoint him. That was the main thing. I mean, I was gone, really.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was possible not to appoint him. And we remember, this is 5 years of social change.
Yeah.
So then Bannon took it to Cabinet and said, basically, look, this is the situation, you know. And Cabinet, a Labour Cabinet, said, it's more important, we've fought for years for the appeal system, it's more important to support that than it is to worry about the State Library, because if it was none of them knew anything about the bloody State Library.
No, they wouldn't.
So 5 years of social change just
thrown in.
Absolutely came to an end. And I left the next day. I walked out and I've never been back in until this morning.
Yes.
And fundamentally, the day I left, which was in a hurry, I'm getting to why this is relevant to Wiz actually, but the day I left, the guys in the bindery who were absolutely devastated because I'd changed their working lives dramatically, they hastily got a book of Baudin's journals. And they bound it in red leather, red and gold leather. And they didn't have time to do anything other than, literally, it was a rush job. Inside, they wrote, "Thanks for the fresh air." And I've still got that. That's beautiful.
How lovely. Yeah.
But I was devastated to leave those guys because they really, they were amazing. The reason I'm sort of mentioning it, I suppose, is that what happened after that, I left Adelaide. Shortly after, I was being considered for the director of the museum. Within the, I had 12 months of being like the walking dead. You know, I mean, nobody would talk to me. Like I'd been mates with, you know, and Bannon, not mates, but you know, I knew them well and knew the Jeff Anderson and whatever. And they couldn't look me in the face. You know, it was terrible, really. And MacPhail made sure that I still got paid a reasonable amount, and I set up the public records office in that time, and KISSA, actually.
That's what happened.
That's what happened. But I was being considered for the director of the museum's job when I got headhunted to Victoria. And I think I owe Deborah a thank you for that. They wanted to, so they appointed me. I went over for lunch. 35th floor of the Rialto building, you know,
how charming, yeah.
And got the job. And I was the second most senior woman in the Victorian Public Service for about 5 minutes, and then others came, of course. So my job was Assistant Director General, Ministry of Employment and Training, which was a better job than the State Librarian's job here. And I had a small child. My daughter was six, seven. And I just thought, I owe it to all the people who've stood by me and supported me in the library and wherever. I think I have to take, it was a 2-year appointment. And I spoke with my ex-husband. We were getting on all right, and we shared our upbringing of our daughter. And we worked out that if she flew over to, if I flew her over to Melbourne every other weekend and I came back here in the meantime and all school holidays, and, you know, it would still be 50-50 more or less. He'd do the Monday to Friday stuff. And so that's what actually happened. And off I went. And that was it, really, as far as... well, then the story gets more interesting in various ways. But, you know, so what I'm really getting to, and I'm sorry to have been so long-winded about it, but the day I left, my goodbye to South Australia was in the Women's Information Switchboard in 1983. And everybody was there, you know, everybody was there.
Well, I would have been, I was overseas then.
Were you? It was a party and a half, I tell you. Carmel was there.
We had some good parties in there.
Yeah, she was running the place at the time. Jim Crawford was there, you know, Ann Levy, whoever, whatever. It was a really good send-off. It was fabulous. But, I mean, it was heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking, all that work to have been done. And
Well, you can still look around and see what great things have happened.
Look, well, one of the things that happened, which what was happening to me had been being looked at by women all over the country, and also Warren Horton being a very powerful person as the, you know,
Chief National Librarian.
Basically, what happened after I lost the job is that women started to be appointed as state librarians all over the country. So Pixie Crook in Sydney. I can't remember who it was in Victoria. It just, you know, it changed things. So, you know, that's the story. That's what happens with women, really. But, you know, all I'd ever wanted to be all my life was a librarian.
And amazing. Well, that was me too. That was going to be my career trajectory, and I went off on different paths, really. But
and I must say, I don't regret any of it, really. One of the things I was invited to do, so it must have been before I left here, or maybe I was invited to come back, because I must have been in Victoria at the time or something. Oh, I came back as director of the social justice strategy some years later, in 87. So I was back in the Premier's department as a director. And I remember being asked to give a speech to the annual group of graduates coming out of the Institute of Technology, I think it was. It was the Library and Information Services or something or other, whatever.
Yeah, whatever it was called by then,
And I gave this little talk, and this is also something that is good for people to hear if they should ever want to hear any of this stuff. But fundamentally, I explained to them, I said, look, you know, all I ever wanted to do was to be a librarian. But, you know, in life, it's not quite like that. It's not sort of linear. Mm. And if you go up, if you stay in the same groove, and you'll go up very slowly, a year at a time, if you're lucky, bit by bit by bit, it's a long process. Mm. I've found that by sometimes being forced rather than choosing, sometimes choosing, to take a sideways shuffle into a completely different area, you can come back up here.
Mm.
You can actually jump lots of steps.
Mm.
And if you keep doing that, it makes you a more rounded person.
Yeah.
And in the end, you've got more to offer, really,
yeah.
You know. And it, at the time, it might feel absolutely devastating.
Mm.
But actually, all change is good. So
my
advice to young ones is, yeah. You know, just take the opportunities that come along. And sometimes they're forced on you rather than chosen, you know. But I don't regret a thing. I think it's been, I've been very fortunate to have had a lot of different experiences, and it's worked.
Yes, it's been great. So I'm just trying to, did you actually spend much time at WIS observing what was going on?
No, I did actually, yeah. Because
so can you talk about what your observations from those very early days? Because I think
that would be
useful.
Remember I was in this, I was running the State Library for, you know, a couple of years really.
Mm.
And WIS was next door. I mean, that we
That's
were,
right,
in fact, I was on the board, I think, or the, something like that. I mean,
some management committee, I think.
Yes, there was a management committee.
Or was it a collective? I can't remember.
No, it was a management committee. It was a management committee. That's right.
I think the workers were called a collective. We had a collective.
Yeah, I think that's right.
We had a collective. I think there was a management committee that the collective.
I went to those meetings regularly, every month or whatever it was.
Mm.
And we would sit in the office, about half a dozen of us. And we would actually make things happen. I mean, it was good because I mean, there were other people besides me, but in our respective roles, we were in a position to actually help WIS. So in different ways, we, you know, I'd say, well, hang on a minute, you know, how about this and how about that? And you could move on, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So I was quite involved and kept quite a close eye on it. And they'd come and talk to me too if they had issues, you know, whatever. And so of it, I would say it was welcoming. It was a welcoming place. It was so alive. I mean, it was really
busy.
People were dedicated.
Mm.
They were dedicated.
Mm.
And I mean, as women, nearly everybody involved had been through some range of problems that women have throughout their lives. And so I found it a very, very exciting, dedicated, wonderful place, and a bit irreverent, which was great.
Right. It wasn't part of the bureaucratic mainstream.
And I think, if anything, I would imagine it's probably become more bureaucratic. I hope it hasn't, but I don't know.
I don't work there,
yeah.
So I can't say.
Yeah.
I know there's been various incarnations. At one stage, they moved to the railway arcade. That was good, I believe, from people who I've spoken to and interviewed.
Yeah.
They said that was good because lots of people dropped in then.
Absolutely.
Because they'd be walking along and think, what's a women's information service? What can I ask there?
And also a lot of the people that need that information are likely to be using the trains and the, you know, the buses
and
whatever.
And now it's up in Grenfell Street.
Yeah.
Just near Consumer Affairs and along there opposite.
Mm.
A bit further along near the traffic lights, near the Adelaide Arcade and the Regent Arcade. It's up there, except on the other side of the road.
Is it on the ground floor?
Yeah, it's on the ground floor. And you have an invitation to visit.
I'd love to.
I'll be walking up there afterwards. I've got to drop in all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But we're supposed to have done we're meant to have done a pre-interview before the interview, but I've been skipping the pre-interview because I figure we can just, you know,
absolutely
sign all the forms and do it all in one day.
Yeah, absolutely.
To be honest,
yeah.
When we're all busy,
yeah.
I figured the pre-interview wasn't really necessary. So, but you are invited to come,
and there will be
some sort of function in July.
July,
I believe.
Oh,
that's the plan. What that function will be, I do not know.
Well, if I can be advised of the date as soon as you've got one.
I will make sure.
I do travel a fair bit
And as soon as I know, at the moment they're talking, I think because I've interviewed a few other people who've said exactly the same thing. Mm. And someone said around the 11th of July, mm-hmm. is they're waiting for the minister to mm-hmm. confirm the date. I can't tell you who the minister is. Mm-hmm. I haven't quite got to that. But I will apparently meet the new minister on Wednesday.
Oh, of course.
There's a volunteer morning tea for volunteers at WIS. Uh-huh. So I will get to find
out
who.
That's good. So they're still...
Well, the new minister's coming. Uh-huh. So, and that's very important that they get to know all about it. Yeah. And I'm not sure who that is yet, but I will do my best to...
And people like Frances Bedford, they're doing a good job too.
Oh, yeah, she's a great woman.
She's a great woman. She was just heard her on the news on the way in. What is it she's doing? She's something.
Well, she's been very involved with the Muriel Matters.
Yes, she has.
Society,
but there's something she's actually. She's
and
actually
she's stood
a
as an independent
member's bill
she?
Or something.
Yeah, she's stood as an independent and she's done very well.
She's been
and she's
good.
Held on to her principles. When
yes.
They were
pushing her
in different directions.
Yes, indeed.
And trying to kick her out so that some of those younger union men could get in and get their opportunity.
Yeah, nothing, you know,
I mean,
the more things
like,
change, the more they stay the same,
oh,
really.
Oh, nothing like valuing women's contribution, is it?
Yeah. I
feel a bit sad about Steph Key for the same reason, because she did a great job, Steph, but she sort of was elbowed out a bit too, I think.
Oh, look, the stories.
A lot of things have happened to women over time
they
in political
have.
Parties. It's not always easy.
Sometimes they try and send you mad. Or
well, that's right. So let me see what other issues. So I guess we've talked about the support group and how important it was and... The kinds of. Do you know anything about the phone-ins and things that were held during the 80s?
The 80s, I wasn't there.
Yeah,
well,
so
I was
you
up
were,
until 83.
Yeah, so we had phone-ins on domestic violence, women and housing, parental stress, women of disability, family law, all those things.
I can't say I can
no,
add
you
much
don't
to
remember
that.
Any of those. Okay.
I remember things happening, but I don't.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really recall.
Okay, I think that's. Are there other things that you think we need to? Talk about in terms of your involvement at the very beginning of Switchboard, because for me, as somebody who was there at the beginning, I was very aware of your name. I knew you were part of the library, and I knew that you were somebody WIS turned to, because I was often the volunteer representative on the collective, so I was really involved back then, even though I've been out of it for quite a long time.
I know your
time.
Name so well, I'm sure.
So,
but yeah, I was the kind of you know, I was the tough bureaucrat,
the go-to bureaucrat
that could actually, you know.
This is how you manage this circumstance.
Yeah, and I mean, sometimes some of the ideas were a little bit crazy, and you had to kind of say, well, look, if you were just to think about doing it that way, you'd be more likely to get this kind of help or that kind of help, you know. So
that's right.
Well, we each play our role. And,
practical advice is really good.
And I must say, the library was. It was a good location for it initially.
Oh,
you know,
it was.
Absolutely was.
I look back now and I think the occupation health and safety issues of that building, when we were there on our own, on weekends and nights, completely, we used to structure our shifts so that often there was just one person there till 9:30 at night.
Yeah.
And now I think about it and I think, that would never be allowed to happen now. And luckily... We all managed the circumstances, but I remember walking out a domestic violence man who came in looking for his wife and blaming me for her going to a shelter that day, and I just kept invading his personal space till he kept stepping backwards till the end. I said, oh, thank you so much for coming and locked the door. But, you know, I think about it now and I think, how dangerous was that? But we were a bit naive in some of those sort of
absolutely.
Structures.
I think
we hadn't thought about occupation, health and safety. And certainly for a lot of us, we didn't understand superannuation.
Yes.
And I was temporary for years and I really didn't think I should... I'm not going to bother with superannuation because...
I never had super.
Except
when I went to...
They won't make me permanent. Now I think, how stupid was that?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. It's a bit of a shame.
So there's those things that changed over time.
They did change over time.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I spent many years working till 9:30 in the reference library here, you know, in the early years. And when you think about it now, I mean, you did get a lot of strange people coming to the library.
That's right. Well, like, we used to get some strange ones in there too. Well, it is. And there's still people like that here today, I think.
I used to work in Worcestershire in England.
Oh, yeah.
And we'd get all the old guys coming in and drying their socks on the radiators in the winter and having a bit of a snooze in the corner, you know, whatever. There was a bit of that here as well, actually.
Oh, absolutely,
I'm just trying
to think who else. So you wouldn't know about what it was like before and after the internet?
And no idea,
any of
actually.
None of that stuff.
But I do hope they're on the ball and doing it.
Oh, they seem to have a good system. I was part of the introduction of computers for volunteers back in... I was acting coordinator for about 6 months.
Right.
Back in about 1990, I think.
Yeah.
And we got a little nest of computers and put them in the middle of the room and put the KISSA information database on it and trying to persuade some of the older volunteers that it was possible to use this when they really wanted to cling to those
cards,
pink cardboard cards, or at most going to the yellow KISSA directory.
Oh.
I'd be happy to do that and trying to convince them that was all on the computer.
Yeah.
It was quite entertaining, really. But we got there, and now all the volunteers, everybody uses computers, and they've done some good things over the years. And one of the things they did was when ATMs first came in, they used to run lessons for women on how to use an ATM.
Oh, really?
Is really so practical. When a lot of older women were absolutely terrified of this new technology. And they used to, they've done that sort of stuff.
That's fantastic.
Yeah,
that's
which really is
really
good. And they go out to field days. And they've now got two projects, one happening in the north in a community centre and one happening down at Aldinga in a children's centre. And they've got little...
For children or for women?
No,
for mothers?
Is outreach. Volunteers are running at outreach information services in those two locations so that women who are bringing their children in for childcare can access information and get really good referrals.
That's excellent.
That's really worked out really well.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Do you remember the Every Woman's Survival Guide?
Yes, that little book? God, yeah,
yes.
I do actually.
Well, I was the project officer got that together because I had been sent to a meeting on the Women's Services Collective or something, and for some reason Women's Health and the Working Women's Centre and all those Women's Liberation, a whole lot of us all got together and decided that we needed a little book.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody wrote a chapter.
Aww.
And then we got a CEP project officer, Monica Clements, and then we hired two clerical people to work as well, and the three of them got it together, and I had the pleasure and joy of helping them pull it all together and get it sorted.
Fantastic.
But that was a great little innovation, and we tried to circulate that through hairdressers and places where women wouldn't normally
expect to see it.
Doctor surgeries, we had them all over the place. Dentists, we sent them out.
And what's happening these days?
Well, they don't have that publication anymore.
It's all online.
It's all online. But they do have a website and they do quite a lot of proactive stuff. I'm now, because I've sort of snuck back into being a volunteer at Westbio Circuitous.
I had a look at the website thinking I might find a phone number that would be of some use. And I have to say, it seemed a bit dense.
Yeah, well,
it just didn't seem to be any...
Wasn't obvious.
It's like a lot of things these days. You can't even find a phone. You can't get a phone number for a bank or for, you know, all sorts of things.
Oh, yeah, I know.
You know, and I find that I'm old enough to think that's just bloody ridiculous. You know, I want to talk to someone, you know,
right.
Whatever.
You want to ask somebody. Yeah, that's right. Well, I think the personal approach is really important.
Yeah, I do too.
But I've got sort of inveigled back in because I know people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can say, well, you need to talk to this person or that person. And I've referred quite a few people in and done quite a lot of interviews,
which
I've really enjoyed because I've had the pleasure of catching up with people who I haven't seen for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. So it's been good for me too.
Well, I've been out of the state. I mean, I've always had a place here. My daughter's here and my grandson. And
all right.
So,
do you want some water?
Yeah, I'd love some. I worked in Victoria for a while, a couple of years. And then I came back here for 4 years as director in the Premier's department. And then, what did I do after that? Oh, then I, that's right, I resigned again because nobody was going to do anything about anything worthwhile. And the Treasury people said, you can't do that. We were going to ask you to do a report on blah, blah, blah. And I went, oh, you'll have to pay me as a consultant, boys. And I was joking. And they said, oh, okay. So before everybody was a consultant, this was way back in 91.
You were a consultant.
I became a consultant. So I did a lot of problem solving, you know, fixing up the parks or trying to and whatever, different things. Mm. And for a few years. And then, of course, by that stage, I'd met the monks. And my interest in writing interminable reports for governments that didn't want to do anything, you know.
Well, you found other things to keep you interested in.
I remember
involved.
The best, well, not the best, no, but a piece of work I did, which Anne Dunn landed on my lap for some reason.
Yeah, I remember
it was actually for the Victorian government, and it was about gambling and whether they should introduce pokies. Mm. This was in Victoria.
Oh, yeah.
And I investigated it, investigated the past history and all the kind of, you know, attorney generals and whoever who'd had something to say on the subject over the years. And I wrote a report for government which I fully expected to be filed without anybody paying any attention, which was exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. Basically, I said, don't do it. You know, do not do this. You were told 10 years ago, you were told 20 years ago, basically... It's true.
Yeah.
It is a really socially terrible thing to do.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to hear that.
No, the hotels.
More of the money.
Hotels lobby group is very powerful, isn't it?
Oh, God, I remember meeting them, yeah. Mm. They were very convincing.
Mm.
It was so lovely for the old people to come and have scones and cream and have lunch.
Yes, and
there was no
tea,
cost.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was so lovely for them to get out of the house.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yes.
Shocking. It's
One of the things I think is interesting about WIS is that, I don't know if you remember this, but we used, at one stage in the 80s, we had Maggie Martinelli, or Maggie Calvert, she started off being called, and she ran a Social Security phone-in, and that eventually turned into the Welfare Rights Centre.
Oh, right.
Which was funded for about, up until very recently, it's only lost funding in the last 2 years or something.
Right.
And that group gave specialist advice to recipients of Social Security for a very, very long time. They were employing lawyers and were doing great work.
Oh, fantastic.
And that grew out of WIS.
Right.
Yeah, excellent. So that was a little offshoot. And the Women's Legal Service, that's now been going for about 10, 15 years, it grew out of WIS too.
Wow.
It started while I was at the Legal Services Commission, and it was set up by a lot of the women who...
Well, Robin
Croydon?
No, Robin Layton.
Oh, yes, Robin
was also
Layton.
Involved,
yes, I know
in the
Robin.
Very early days, yeah. Too, at least supportive anyway. I don't know that she was had much to do with it, but...
She
I mean,
used
she
to
was
turn
around
up
the
to
traps.
Events. Yeah, yes, she used to turn up to events. I remember her wonderful coloured hair.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, gosh.
That's right. But, so the Women's Legal Service was almost another offshoot because that grew out of the Saturday afternoon Women's Legal Service that we used to run at WIS, where the lawyers used to come in, and then eventually we used to ring them at their home for them to give legal advice. And then eventually we set up this Women's Legal Service, and that was necessary because... All the other community legal centres, a lot of very abusive men used to go to every single service, and that meant their wife had nowhere to go.
Yes,
to get
course.
Legal advice that was free. And the good thing about the Women's Legal Service is that he couldn't go there.
Right.
Mm. So there's at least two services that offshoot.
I mean, you're going to be the recipient of a lot of information here, and I don't know whether it's you or someone else, but... It'd be really good to have that written up in terms of what's actually blossomed out of WIS.
That's right. Well, I'm talking about it in these interviews as I get the opportunities.
Yeah, but I mean, it'd be good to
actually... I don't
to
know
actually,
what they're doing about right
Wouldn't
now.
That be nice? Yeah. It'd be so good, you know.
Yeah, well, I think
The only thing that wasn't so good in the current... This is very pertinent to the current situation facing a lot of women and men... do you remember a woman called Susie? Susie something or other?
Susie Riggs.
Yeah. And I remember her running a financial planning evening.
Yeah.
The Financial Planning Network, I think they called it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the fortunate position at that time of having a bit of spare money and wondering what to do. And I remember coming along to this evening and they were offering these free consultations. And I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. I'll have a bit of a yarn with these people and see. Mm. And I remember sitting in this little room with this woman who was saying, oh, well, you know, what do you want to do and what have you got? And, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, well, you know, how does this all work and whatever? And she's saying, oh, well, you know, you can invest in this company or that company or whatever. And I'm going, oh. So I said, so where do you get your money from? Like, how do you earn your money? Oh, it's all free. It's all free. No, I mean, who pays you? And she did not want to answer that question. It took a lot of, and in the end, I went, no, I get it. Yeah. No thanks. Mm. And I just hope a lot of women didn't take financial planning advice.
That was after, because I left, I think that was happening.
I just remember, that was, God, that'd be, you know, I mean, that's what, 20 years ago nearly.
Yeah, that would have been in the late 80s, was it?
Yeah, I think Susie Riggs left, didn't she, to set up something like that. She actually went and worked for a financial.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, when you see what's happening now, financial planners,
right.
it was that long ago. Mm-hmm. And women would have been very vulnerable to that. I mean, I wasn't, but, you know, I mean, a lot of them would be.
When I think about, you know, the lists we had of plumbers and electricians and female doctors and female this and female that, there was no quality control. No one ever investigated to see if these were ethical, good practitioners. Yeah, yeah. They would just happen to be female. Yeah, and we would just hand out three names and say, well, ring them up and check them out for yourselves. But now when I look back at it, I think, well, there was no quality control.
We had no idea
whether these people were registered builders or whatever.
Yeah.
We just referred people basically on the base of their gender, and really without knowing how qualified and capable they were. But, you know, I haven't heard of any lawsuits, so we got away with it, and maybe always giving three names helped, because
it might have,
ultimately someone had to make the
decision. Look, in life generally, what I've discovered, I mean, I'm just a very, you know, down-to-earth Scot, really, when it boils down to it, but some good friends of mine who are, you know, intelligent people. Like, they're intelligent people. You know, they've either got their own business or their journals or their, you know, whatever. They've got businesses. And they've never had any money, really. Not really, you know, had any much money. And they've come into a bit of money one way or the other. Mm. And all of them invested it in things that went bust. Mm. They lost it.
Mm.
You know, and I just think, like, how come? Like,
yeah, I know.
God,
there's been,
you know,
some very strange things happened. And you think sensible people don't. When it comes to money, some people seem to go off.
If they haven't had any and then they get some, I think that's when they're really vulnerable, you know.
That difference, yeah.
And, it always bothered me that, as I say, even people I knew, well, why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you ask? Why didn't you know?
Why didn't you tell me? Yeah.
But anyway,
so
my business.
So the name of the man, Jack, who was on the senior bureaucrat, the Public Service Board. Does that name come back to you?
Jack Ellis. Jack. Oh, my God.
Anyway, if it comes to you, let me know, because they're bound to...
He'd be dead a long time ago.
Yeah.
He had, I think he had a melanoma, actually.
Oh,
he had cancer, and that was a long, long time ago, like 25 years ago.
But if suddenly that... Because sometimes things float back into your mind after something like this, when you've been talking about the old days. I find that a couple of days later...
I'll tell you who'd know, but
things.
I wouldn't speak to him, the bastard.
Ian MacPhail.
Is he around? I mean,
I don't know.
I think he's interstate these days. I don't know where he is
now. I have no idea.
But Mike Schilling. Mike Schilling.
I don't know him.
Well, he was... He wasn't a commissioner, but
he's
was a...
He's a name that I remember from...
Yeah.
The bureaucracy.
I'd say he was one of the guys that didn't want me to have the same salary as him. I'd say he was one of those. But he writes letters to the Australian all the time.
Does he? Oh, well, we know where his politics are.
Exactly, exactly. And I just, you know, I feel like writing to the paper going, for God's sake, what is this? You know, doesn't anybody else write to you?
No.
This prick is every week, you know. I still buy the Australian because there's nothing else to read, and I love newspapers. If you know where they're coming from.
The Guardian Weekly.
Oh, yeah, of course. I've read The Guardian for many years.
I've bought The Guardian forever.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't buy it.
We used to buy it in England way back and then buy it when we got here, you know. But anyway, and the Saturday paper is...
It is. Anyway, I'd like to thank you, Maureen Fallon, for your time and for your discussion of the formation of the Women's Information Switchboard. Thank you.